असतो मा सद्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्युर्मा अमृतं गमय ॐ शांति शांति शांतिः। ॐ लीड अस फ्रॉम द अनरियल टू द रियल, लीड अस फ्रॉम डार्कनेस अनटू लाइट, लीड अस फ्रॉम डेथ टू इमॉर्टैलिटी। ओम पीस पीस पीस। नमस्ते एंड गुड मॉर्निंग एवरीबॉडी। इट्स अ रियली ब्यूटिफुल विंटर संडे। यस, द सब्जेक्ट विच वी हैव टेकन अप दिस मॉर्निंग इज इंटरेस्टिंग, प्रोफाउंड, वेरी डीप, वेरी नॉन ड्यूअल। Surprise, surprise. Yes, the universe as seeing. It's a theme which comes again and again in Advaita Vedanta. We'll talk about it today. Today I'm going to draw centrally from this book, The Nectar of Supreme Knowledge. I've been giving a few talks on this on and off in the last few months. This is actually an English translation of Yoga Vashishta Sara, which translates as the essence of Yoga Vashishta, and that is actually a condensation or an extract, let's say, from the original Yoga Vashishta. The Yoga Vashishta Ramayana is a huge book, more than 30,000 verses. So the context there, I've mentioned it earlier also, but just to recapitulate, the prince Rama, young Rama, he suddenly becomes very non-dualistic and he decides, I won't be a king, I don't want this kingdom, I want to go away and, you know, become enlightened and go away into the forests or mountains and become enlightened. I want to give up the world. So his father, the king, is of course naturally worried. If you don't have the prince, the crown prince, it goes away. And then who's going to run the kingdom, all sorts. And the irony of the Ramayana is that later on the father himself will send the prince away on 14 years of exile into the forest. But anyway, I think Rama could have said, I told you so, I wanted to go to the forest anyway. But dad being a dad would probably say, you go when I tell you to go, not when you want to go. So he asks the sage Vashishta to counsel the prince. And Vashishta says to Rama, it's wonderful that you want to become enlightened, you want to give it all up and, you know, live like a monk and become enlightened. That's wonderful, you want to give up the world and find God or find Brahman. But tell me this, is the world other than Brahman? This Brahman which you are seeking, is it somewhere else? Is this not also Brahman? So that's the theme, and it's a huge, long teaching with a lot of philosophy, a lot of stories. It's a fascinating book. For our benefit, an unknown author, centuries ago, that much we know, it's not old, it's not new. Yoga Vashishta Sara is at least a few centuries old. Some unknown author extracted about 200 odd verses, which are the essential non-dual teachings from the whole book. Then one of our monks, Swami Dheereshanandaji, who was in our ashram, the hospital in Kankhal, which is near Haridwar, which is in Haridwar now, basically. He made a Bengali translation of the Yoga Vashishta Sara with extensive, that's the value of that Bengali translation. It has extensive notes on Advaita Vedanta. So one of the monks who inspired me, a very non-dualistic monk, Kalipada Maharaj, Swami Shiva Pradhanandaji, he would give that book, the Bengali version of this book, as a present to everybody who showed interest in non-dualism. So that book, it gives you an insight into many abstruse, many deep concepts in Advaita Vedanta, teachings in non-dual Vedanta, that the notes of Dheereshanandaji. So now we have this book translated by Sarvadevanandaji. This is Nectar of Supreme Knowledge, English translation of the original Yoga Vashishta Sara, and translation of all those notes, those valuable notes. Now, why am I giving you this detailed background? The reason is, today what we are going to do is almost entirely based on one such note in the Bengali original, translated here. One note by Swami Dhireshanandaji on one of the verses in this book. I will also draw upon none other than the Holy Mother, Ma Sharada Devi, one of her conversations with one of her monastic disciples. We will draw upon, of course, Shankara. We will draw upon contemporary philosophers, especially a philosopher called Malkani, who is forgotten, basically. But he was a great philosopher, at least in the non-dual Advaita, modern Advaitin, G.R. Malkani, Ghanshyam Das Ratanmal Malkani. I'll draw heavily upon him today. Also a contemporary philosopher who's right here in Stony Brook. Right now we are very lucky to have Sthaneshwar Timmalsina, who is an authority on Advaita Vedanta and especially Kashmir Shaivism. And we are going to actually have him speak here in a couple of months' time. So on one of his books, I'll draw from that also. Anyway, so it's a rich morning we have before us. And I hope to wrap it all up to show how it can directly help us in our non-dual inside, non-dual realization. All right. Now let's go to the verse which we are going to base our discussions on. This is in this book. And the verse, I'm going to read it out. This is the last verse of the second chapter. Evam nasannasad iti bhranti matram vijrimbhate anubhuyata evashu kinchit sarvanubhutitaha. So when you realize Brahman, when you realize the ultimate reality, which is existence, consciousness, bliss, what happens is this world which we are seeing, evam nasat, nasat, evam in this way, once you have realized. Already two chapters are over, they are expecting that you are already enlightened. So in this way, when you, as you have realized, then you see this world, it's all that exists in this world and all that does not exist, sat, asat. Or a deeper understanding of that would be the cause and the effect. This entire world, everything here is either a cause and effect, or both, a cause of something else and an effect of something before it. The entire world is linked by causality. And he says, there is really no causality at all. You will see this. Nasat nasat iti. Then what are we seeing? We thought all these things which exist are causes and effects, you know. But then what is it that we are seeing? Bhranti matram vijrimbhate. It's an error, it's an illusion, it's like a dream which appears, which arises. Where? In consciousness itself. There is only this one consciousness, one awareness in which this dreamlike display of the world arises. Anubhuyate vashu. In every experience, you realize just like that. Everywhere, whatever you see in this world, whatever you experience right here. What he means is right here in your kingdom, that Brahman is here. So that's what we are experiencing. This world is an appearance of what? Of Brahman, of the ultimate reality. And that reality is right here and right now. In fact, in one of the verses quoted by Dhireshanji later on, in his notes, just another reference, we don't know what the source is. Maybe Yoga Vashishta, but we don't see the source. Yadrigeva param brahma tadrigeva jagatrayam. It says, what is the ultimate reality? That which is the ultimate reality. That itself is this world, the three worlds. Your heaven, earth and hell, or the waking, dreaming, deep sleep. It's exactly this thing. You are looking for Brahman here. It's like you're looking for gold and you throw away the golden ornaments and go elsewhere to look for gold. Here you have a golden necklace, you have a golden ring, you have a golden bracelet. And you say, yeah, but I'm not interested in ornaments. I'm off to search for gold. That's the mistake you're making here. So this is the thrust. But our concern here is the status of the world. What is this world? Is it real as we see it? Or is it like a dream? Or is it non-existence? So our theme this today, this morning, will be three approaches to non-duality, three approaches to Advaita Vedanta. All very wonderful, each more incredible than the earlier one, each a little more crazy. Ultimately, we'll end up with something crazy, but it's going to be interesting. The three approaches, and remember, the question here is the status of the world. Yes, it's Brahman. Brahman is existence, consciousness, bliss. But what is this? But what we are experiencing now? This is a question which will come to any non-dualist after some time when you investigate. And it's all very good. I'm not the body, not the mind. I am pure consciousness. Pure consciousness is the reality of the world. The world is appearing in pure consciousness. But all this time, the world I was immersed in, you know, what I was experiencing all this time, what is it? How real is it? How seriously should I take it? And what is it in relation to the ultimate reality which we are trying to discover? This is the question. Three answers, three approaches, let us say. They are called, the Sanskrit names, and I'll translate. One is called Srishti Drishti Vada. It translates as creation first, seeing later. Creation, then seeing. The universe, I'll explain. Then the second one is called Drishti Srishti Vada. Seeing is creation. I'm using the word creation. Srishti actually means projection of the universe. Anyway, seeing is creation or projection. And then Ajatavada, the theory of non-origination. There is no creation. There is no world. The question is dissolved. There's no question to answer anyway. So three approaches. Before we dive into it, remember, it's not that one of them is true and the others are false. I saw this conversation with Ramana Maharshi. And somebody asked him, so what do you teach? Do you teach Ajat? He's often associated with that highest teaching of Advaita Vedanta, the sort of final approach to it, Ajata. Do you teach that? He said, I support all three. He said, I support all three. Creation and then experience, the experience and creation, and the non-origination. I support all three. And then the question was, but one of them must be true. All of them can't be true at the same time. Because one says the world is real, the other says the world is like a dream. How can both be true at the same time? And the answer, I'm paraphrasing what he said, is very perceptive, very deep. The answer is, actually none of them are true. Advaita Vedanta, which is very simple about it. Advaita Vedanta actually is teaching us only Brahman is real. There's only one non-dual Brahman. It's because we think we are trapped in this world of whether real or dream or whatever, and we need a way out of this, and we are interested in the status of this world, and there's no way of teaching us without talking about this world. And therefore, the teachers give us multiple approaches, none of which are ultimately true. What is ultimately true? Advaita Vedanta makes no secret about it. Advaita Vedanta says Brahman alone is real. The world is an appearance and you are Brahman. That is the final position of Advaita Vedanta. Even more precisely, Brahman alone is real. One non-dual existence, consciousness, bliss. As far as you can put it in language, that is the ultimate reality. Advaita Vedanta is quite clear and you are that. But these three are approaches. Why three approaches? What are they? And how do they work? How are they different? That's what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about one particular approach today, which is the position being taken by this book, which is the second one, the Drishti Srishti Vada, the treating the world as an appearance, as a dream. So let's start with the first one, Srishti Drishti Vada, and then we'll proceed. The first one says that it's a common sense approach to non-duality. Non-duality itself is difficult, so don't make it more difficult than it needs to be. So let's just start where people are. That's good teaching. That's good pedagogy. The teacher should start where the student is. The way we feel about the world, Advaita Vedanta says, Let's start there. Let's take that seriously, and we will start and go to the Advaitic realization step by step. What do we feel about the world? That the world is there. It's real. It's here. And it predates us. The world existed and we were born into it. And then we saw it. This is called Srishti Drishtivada. The world was created by God or by Big Bang or whatever. It's there. And it's been around for billions of years. And we were born recently. And having been born into this pre-existing world, we are now experiencing it. Srishti first, creation first, and Drishti next, experiencing it next. So we are experiencing it now. So that's like, that's the common sense position we all take. That's what we automatically believe in. We don't have to really think too deeply about this. And Vedanta says, let's start there. So most of the Vedantic teachings, if you see the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita, they all take this position. Shankaracharya's commentaries almost always takes this position. If you remember, say, our introductory text, if those who have studied Vedanta Sara, or generally any Vedantic text, what does it tell us about this world and about our real nature? What it tells us is this. There is Brahman, existence, consciousness, bliss. With its power of Maya, that Brahman is called God, Ishvara, Saguna Brahman. And what does that God do? That God uses its power of Maya to project itself as this universe. The Taittiriya Upanishad, which we were just studying, listening to the beautiful chant, Satyam Jnanam Anantam Brahma. Brahman is limitless existence consciousness. Satyam Jnanam Anantam Brahma. But just a couple of lines after that, that same Upanishad says, Tasmad va etasmad atmanah akasha sambhuta. From that Brahman, which is also the self, the Atma, what happened? The space was projected. Akasha sambhuta. Akashad vayu vayu ragni agni rapa adhya prithivi. From space came air or wind. And from air came fire. From fire came water. From water came this earth. And by the mixture of these five elements, this is ancient cosmology, it's common to many ancient cultures, including India. So by a combination of these five elements, this entire universe was created, including our bodies. It'll say the worlds were created and plants and vegetables grew there. Eating those plants and vegetables, we converted it into our body. From this body, the children are born. So our bodies are produced from the parents' bodies, which are produced from the food they eat, which is produced from the earth, which is produced from the five elements. And primordially, this comes from the Atman through, within brackets, its power of Maya, it projects this. And we are born into it. We sentient beings, it's the same Brahman, but filtered through ignorance, ajnana, it assumes, it appears as millions of billions of sentient beings who are unaware of their real nature. That's you and I and all of us. And then we go through lifetime after lifetime experiencing this world, a pre-existing world. And we go on our spiritual journey lifetime after lifetime until we spiritually evolve. And finally, we embark consciously on our journey to enlightenment, and then we become enlightened and free. We realize we are Brahman, we always were. That's it. So this is the whole story. End of story? No, not end of story. So this is called Srishti Drishtivada. Creation first, God created it. Somebody, it's there, and we come into it. And then we move ahead in our spiritual life. It's a sort of common sense approach. Then it is said to us, this is for the lowest category of spiritual seeker. We think non-dual Vedanta is very difficult and only for a few. There also it's said, what you all learned till now is, how do we put it, Vedanta for dummies. And there is another way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is, no. It's not that there's a God who created this world. Rather, you are there as consciousness. For some inexplicable ignorance, you think of yourself as this body-mind in this world. you project it like a dream. Yeah. This is the second approach. In the dream, when we enter into a dream, and we don't remember that we are dreaming, we feel it's a world. Probably there's a God who has created this world, space, fire, water, air, whatnot, and it's been going on for billions of years, and I'm here in this world, and I'm interacting with people, going through life, all sorts of weird and strange things happen. I don't even know it's a dream until I wake out of it. But when I wake up, then I realize that world I had entered in the dream, all the people there, the places there, the events which happened, even possibly a God I believed in that world, all of it was the projection of my dreaming mind. I was lying in bed and happily sleeping, and my mind dreamt. And the mind set up and projected me into the dream also. So the whole thing was projected, including the universe, including all the people, including all the events. So the seeing of the dream is the very existence of the dream. Look at the contrast. Earlier, the universe existed, then we come to see it. Srishti Drishti Vada. But now, in the second theory, which is our mainstay today, we are saying that you are seeing, therefore the universe exists. What happens in a dream? Everybody in that dream, every place in that dream, every event in that dream, it lasts as long as you are seeing. Even the whole dream universe, it lasts as long as you are dreaming. The moment you stop dreaming and go into deep sleep, or you wake up into the waking world, that whole dream with its contents, its dream universe, its people, its events, good and bad, all of them disappear. They not only disappear, you also awaken with the realization, oh, it was just a dream. What do you mean it was just a dream? It was not real. What you mean is it was not real. This waking world, I'm sitting up in the bed here, this is real. That was just a dream. And this is said to be the Srishti Drishti Vada. Drishti Srishti Vada, sorry. Your seeing itself is the creation. Dream, your seeing the dream is the creation of the dream world. Are we seeing the difference between these two? This is said to be the teaching which will be useful for, they say, Madhyama Adhikari, the middling seeker. A little better than the dummy. It's a little... What do you mean by the middling seeker, the dummy, or the Mandha Adhikari, and the best category? The difference is in the excellence. This is a technical way of putting it. Excellence in sadhan chatushtay, fourfold qualification, this discernment between the eternal and the non-eternal, complete vairagya, dispassion for worldliness, for worldly goals, the sixfold disciplines, control of the mind, control of the senses, etc., and then in mumukshutvam, intense desire for freedom. If you have it to some extent, not too good, it's good to start with the Srishti Drishti. And that's why most of the teaching, including masters of Vedanta like Shankara, who is the greatest figure in Advaita Vedanta, they generally, I'm saying that carefully, they generally give a Srishti Drishti teaching. That is, the world exists, common sense, the way you think about it, and now let's go towards the teaching of non-duality. Whereas some teachers, notably Shankara's teacher's teacher, Gaudapada, he gives this Drishti Srishti teaching, and also the Ajata teaching, we'll see that also is there. So those will be effective for people, as somebody said, you have to be a little desperate for that to be effective. So you have to picture what they say in the high Himalayas, bahut phakkar mahatma the. So that word phakkar means, in the plains it means a homeless guy, a kind of penniless, jobless vagabond, like that. But in the high Himalayas it means a monk who doesn't care for anything in this world. So I asked one of the monks, what's the difference? Is there a difference between Shankar? It seems to be. There's a difference. One is Drishti Srishti, one is Srishti Drishti. And he said, oh, Gaudapad to bhakkar mahatma the. So Gaudapad, Shankara's guru's guru, was this kind of a teacher who... So his teaching you have to handle with care. It says, buyer beware. What's the thing? Buyer beware? there's a phrase. Caveat emptor. Caveat emptor, yes. So buyer beware. You have to be careful about... Then I asked him, if that is Gaudapada, then what was Shankaracharya? And the monk said, oh, Shankaracharya to Jagat Guru thi. He is the world teacher. So world teacher has to carry everybody along. It's no good if you are a wonderful teacher, you have the highest teacher, but nobody understands what you are saying. And you're no good to anybody except the, you know, the odd genius in the class. Everybody else doesn't know what's going on. There is another way of understanding these two positions, Srishti Drishti and Drishti Srishti, is Srishti Drishti is based on the waking state paradigm. Drishti Srishti is based on the dream state paradigm. The waking state paradigm is, as we regard the world in the waking state, here it exists. This is my room. It existed even when I was sleeping. It didn't disappear. Here's my job. It doesn't. Sometimes it may disappear. So the jobs are like that little bit of a drishti srishti in this, especially in Manhattan. Yeah. If you take your eyes off it, it suddenly disappears. A tendency of disappearing. So it's all there. The family, the job, the house, and the car, and all of that. It exists even when I'm not experiencing it. So this is the waking state. I may forget it. I may go from this room to that room. That doesn't mean that room disappeared. You may go away from Vedanta Society. Doesn't mean Vedanta Society disappeared. Or it flashed into being the moment you came into it. Doesn't, not at all. Not like a dream. The dream is when you stop seeing it, it's not there anymore. We are quite clear. You are having pizza in your dream and you say it's time to get up. Let me put the pizza carefully in the refrigerator. I'll come tomorrow when I dream again. I'll come back and eat the pizza. No. The moment you wake up, that world and the refrigerator and the pizza and everything is gone from there. It doesn't exist. So the waking, the drishti drishti is based on the waking world, the way we commonly perceive our, or we understand our world. The drishti srishti, the seeing as the creation of the world, today's topic, the universe as seeing, that is based on the dream paradigm. If we want to explain Advaita Vedanta based on the waking paradigm, Srishti Drishti is your model. If you want to explain and teach Advaita based on the dream paradigm, then Drishti Srishti is your model. Where the world, which world? This waking world. This exists only when you experience it. When you're not experiencing it, it doesn't exist. It says, sounds crazy. Not as crazy as you would think. We'll see. And there is a third one. Let's just see the verse which we just read. It says, whatever you see here, it's not real. There's no real causality. It's an error, an illusion appearing here in the waking state. So this is clearly Drishti Srishti. It doesn't say, no, it exists. God created it. What do you mean it doesn't exist? No, it doesn't exist. It's a projection through Maya or Ajnana. There is a third, it gets crazier. There's a third approach, which is based, you might guess, on the deep sleep paradigm. This is called Ajatavada, the non-origination. The non-origination, the universe is unborn, uncreated. Was it created before we came into being, before we saw it? Srishti Drishti? No. Is it created when we see it or projected when we see it? No. Then what is it? It isn't. It's based on the deep sleep paradigm. How do you see the world in deep sleep? You don't. Your answer will be you don't. There's no world. Nobody who's seeking the world, nobody who's asking a question. And yet it's an experience. Deep sleep is also a kind of an experience. So it's an experience of the absence of the world appearance. In the waking state, we will say not world appearance, world reality. In the dream state, we will say world appearance. In deep sleep, we'll say, no world. Advaita based on deep sleep, that is Ajatavada, the non-origination theory. It's a little difficult to understand. How is it that if you're asleep, we understand. If you're under anesthesia, we understand. But when you are awake with eyes open, seeing this world as Rama is seeing and Vasishtha is teaching him, how can you see this world and say it's not, only Brahman is? So here is a little anecdote, something that I saw myself. this happened about 20 years ago. This was in one of our ashrams in Calcutta, a place called Bodisha, on the outskirts of Calcutta. It's one of our ashrams, and it runs a senior center. There are elderly people there who stay there. We went, I was a newly minted monk at that time. Yeah, I'd just become, I'd got my orders as a sannyasi. So we went to see a couple of elderly gentlemen who were devotees, who were staying there. So we would be a group of senior monks. Now these are monks who knew these gentlemen for decades, you know. So two or three senior monks, some of you may recognize the names, Swami Suhitanandaji, who's now the vice president. Swami Shivamayanandaji was there, who was the vice president, who passed away just a couple of years ago. And Swami Ramanandaji, who is a very senior monk of our order, who's in Banaras now. And then the central character in this anecdote, Swami Mumukshanandaji. Mumukshanandaji was a very senior monk of our order who passed away a few years ago. Very learned, very austere, very humble. He was the president of the Advaita Ashram. He was the president of the Mother's House Ashram. He was the principal at one time of our monastic training center and so on. Very quiet, thoughtful, learned, humble, a wonderful monk. Anybody who has seen him, they will know. So he was also going. And I and a friend of mine who were absolutely newly minted monks, you know, we went along just for to hear the conversation among these seniors, monks, and the other senior devotees they were going to meet. And we are looking forward to a wonderful conversation. That was, we just wanted to listen, you know. So we landed up there. And so the story is this. Among the gentlemen we met was one elderly gentleman who was a noted philosopher. When he was retired at that time, of course. His name was Devdas Bandyopadhyay, but we'll just call him the philosopher. We'll get confused with all these names. The philosopher. Now, we sat down for tea, the senior swamis, and we were in the background, I and my friend, the young monks, and the philosopher and some other gentlemen had come. So the swami in charge of that ashram said to the philosopher, "Well, sir, we have Swami Mumukshananda visiting here. You can ask all your questions and he'll definitely settle all your doubts." And the philosopher was one of the most unique people I have ever met. For the last 40 years, he had been thinking, does God exist or not? When I met him, he still hadn't come to a conclusion. You know, are you going to start your spiritual practices to become enlightened? And he says, first of all, I have to make up my mind whether God exists or not. So he had many questions like a philosopher. No, but I think he was a deeply spiritual man. So he said to Swami Mumukshananji, explain to me Ajatavada. Exact question was, what's the practice of Ajatavada, the non-origination theory? So that means basically, what's it? How is it possible? You see the world and you say it doesn't exist. You can say it's real, you can say it's a dream, but you have to say something about it. How can you just dismiss it like that? That doesn't sound at all rational, unless you are sleeping. So our Mukshanji told us an anecdote. He said, I still remember this. And there was a funny pause also in between. One of the senior monks, who is a very dynamic swami, who's not interested in all this abstruse philosophy. So when he heard this, what is Ajatavada and what, now we're going to discuss that. He said, I'm going to go sit in the boat. Now this is a reference to the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, where two friends came to Sri Ramakrishna and Sri Ramakrishna was talking about God. And the two friends sat there listening to him. One of them loved what he was saying. The other was bored. So the friend said to his friend, whispered, shall we go now? And the friend said, no, let me listen a little more. And this other friend said, okay, I'll go sit in the boat. So this swami, he said, I'll go sit in the boat. There was no boat, but anyway. He knew a lot of non-dual talk is coming. So Swami Mumukshananji said, just think of a boy who lives with his father in some, you know, like deep in the forest. And his father tells, he has never seen anything of civilization, you know. So his father says, it's time you got to know more about the world. I'll take you to the village, the village headman's house. So they don't even live in a village, they live in the forest. So he takes him to the village headman's house, and there for the first time the boy sees furniture. And the father tells him, look, boy, this is a table, this is a chair. The boy said, but father, where's the table or the chair? Here, but this is wood. Said, yes, but it's a table. But where is the table? This is a wood. But this one, the way it is shaped, this is called a table. But why would you call it a table? It's wood. And then Mokshanji said to the Ajatavadin, the one who is this extreme non-dualist, non-origination theory, they are seeing the same reality which we are, but they see straight through to the reality and nothing but the reality. Their drishti, their insight, their philosophical vision is fixed on the reality. They refuse to admit any world to be explained apart from this reality. But look, here are people, here are trees and sky and earth. How do you account for this? But this is Brahman. But why would it be people and tree and sky? But that's how Brahman is. One monk in the Himalayas, he belonged to this school, Ajatavadin. This is a little article which came out in one of our magazines, Prabuddha Bharat. There, he says, he's asked this question. It's all right that you say everything is Brahman, everything is existence, consciousness, bliss. You are immersed in Brahman. But what about the world? Ye jagat kya hai? What is this world? We are sitting here. You can see the mountains and the forests and the monks. What's all this? And the monk said, as if quizzically, he said, I'll tell you in Hindi and translate. Yeah, ye to Brahma ki lap lapat hai. This is the blazing forth of Brahman. It's the flame of Brahman, let us say, flickering. This is Brahman. He does not see any question to be answered. For us, it's too difficult to wrap our minds around what he is saying. One says the world is real. Let us investigate through our spiritual practices and an inquiry. We will discover Brahman and we'll find that we are Brahman and thus attain non-dual knowledge. I am Brahman and attain freedom. That is Srishti Drishtivada. The second one, the one we are discussing, says the world is not real. It's an appearance of Brahman. Go from the appearance to reality, which is Brahman. Realize you are Brahman. You're free. The other one says, Brahman, you're free anyway. There's no question of anything else. So these three approaches. But remember, that is for Uttam Adhikari, the most qualified seeker, highly qualified seeker, who can immediately take benefit of that approach. That's based on the deep sleep paradigm. Another way of looking at these three. Reality, because the question is the reality of the world. So let's talk about reality. I'll just give you a little bit of three paradigms of that. One of them, this Srishti Drishtivada, the common sense approach, one way where we are. This one accepts four levels of reality in Advaita Vedanta. The common person says, one who is not interested in Vedanta or anything like that, says, this is reality, that's it. Nothing more. This is the reality. But those who study Vedanta, not enlightened yet, is studying, we are trying to understand it, we are doing our spiritual practices, we are doing inquiry. What do we say? We say that, yeah, this is relatively real, but we learn from Vedanta there is an ultimate reality called Brahman. So there are already two levels of reality here. What is called paramarthika, the ultimate level of reality. What is ultimate reality? Brahman. The vyavaharika, the transactional or relative reality. What is that? This world. People and Vedanta talks and cars and taxes and wars and peace and all of that. This world, our lives. This is relative reality, this universe which we experience. This is the second level of truth, a lower level of truth. The highest is Brahman. Lower level of truth, this world. It's called vyavaharika, transactional. There's an even lower level of truth. Lower level of reality. Which is fiction. Which is dreams. Which is the snake in the rope. Which is all kinds of error, seeing a mirage in the desert. So all of that, error, illusion, dream, fiction, movies, that's something, it's not nothing. It is a kind of virtual reality. Now we have a nice word, virtual reality. Let's call it virtual reality. So that level is called in Vedanta, it's called Pratibhasika. Literally, it means appearance. That's also a level of reality because, after all, we see movies. And nowadays, we have virtual reality. We actually live in virtual worlds and interact. Somebody was telling me, and I saw on the internet demonstration, something called Apple ProVision. And there are other, Google has its own glasses, and then Meta has its own. So it projects a world in front of you. It literally does. And you can interact with that world. You can instantly see people doing this and this in the air, just like that. It used to be, till now, it's very common. You don't think it's strange of people, just talking into the air. Just standing there, and elderly people used to say, why is he talking to himself? We know he's talking on his on his Apple iPods or something. Yes. But now you'll see people are doing crazy things, like standing in the air, in the open and waving their hands around. They're not crazy. They're working. So we interact with the virtual world. So the virtual world, this is called Pratibhasika, third level of reality. And there is a level of utter unreality. Not even dreams, not even fiction, not even illusions. Just nothing. For example, the classic examples like square circle. We can say it's square circle, but there's nothing corresponding to a square circle. We can say the classic example is a barren woman's son. That is the example given in Sanskrit books, Bandhyaputra. By definition, the barren woman doesn't have a son. So you can use those words, but they don't mean anything. There's nothing corresponding to it. Another example is rabbit's horn. Rabbits don't have horns. So rabbit's horn is a non... There are horns and there are rabbits, but the two are not together. So rabbit's horn... So that is called asat, the fourth level. So you have got these four levels of reality, or rather three levels of reality and one level of unreality. So what are these? Paramarthika, Brahman. Example, Brahman, the ultimate level. Then Vyavaharika, transactional. Example, our world. Pratibhasika, that is illusion, dream, virtual reality, stuff like that. And Asat, unreal, totally unreal. Doesn't exist at all, although we can use words for it. Example, like a square circle or whatnot. There are many words for that. Asat, not existing at all. Tuccha, completely dismissed as unreal. Alika, again means unreal. There are multiple words for it. So four levels. Who says that? We do. You say, but I don't, Swami, you may. But no, we do. We may not express it in these ways, but that's after studying Vedanta, we come to this framework. This is Srishti Drishtivada. Srishti Drishtivada accepts these four levels. The Asat, we can leave it out for the time being. Basically, three levels of reality. Ultimate reality, our transactional, our world reality, and a world of fiction and appearance. Paramarthika, Vyavaharika, and Pratibhasika. Now we move to Drishti Srishtivada. Drishti Srishtivada, one way of understanding Drishti Srishtivada is that paradigm of Advaita Vedanta where there are only two levels of reality. One is Paramarthika, other one is Pratibhasika. Paramarthika, Brahman, and Pratibhasika, appearance, dream, error. What about this? This is also appearance, this is a dream. What about the world? It's a dream. What about dreams? They are dreams. Dreams are dreams, world is a dream, they're all equally appearances. So two levels of reality, no transactional reality, no relative reality. You are the ultimate reality, Brahman, and it appears as these dreams. And of course, there's total unreality, asat. The third paradigm, which is ajatavada, it accepts one level of reality. And that is paramarthika, Brahman only. There's no need to say ultimate reality. There's only reality, Brahman. What is all this? Brahman. What will the Drishti Srishtivada say? What is all this? Dream. Brahman is. I am Brahman. You are Brahman. But this appearance is a dream. What will the Srishti Drishtivadin say? Yes, Brahman is there. We read about it, hear about it. But this is reality, transactional reality. And I accept there's some kind of ultimate reality. So you see the difference? This is one way of understanding it. Another label applied to these three is Trisattavada, Dvisattavada, Ekasattavada. Now we can easily understand. The theory, the framework which accepts three gradations of reality, which is Srishti, Rishti, creation, and then experience. the theory which accepts two gradations of reality, ultimate and appearance, that is drishti srishti vada. The theory which accepts one grade of reality only, that is Brahman, the only reality, which is ajatavada. It's another way of understanding. I still haven't started. Almost time is almost over. Now. Okay. Now I'm going to go into drishti srishti vada a little more carefully. The way to go into it, I'm going to draw upon this philosopher Malkani, G. Ghanshyam Das Ratanman Malkani. It's good to refer to somebody who is sort of not referred to, forgotten. He was a radical non-dualist. He was a professor of philosophy, a founder president of the Indian Institute of Philosophy. A place called, a small little town called Amalner. Still, I hear it's still a small town in Maharashtra, I think. And he was the first president of that. And that place was founded by a businessman, Srimant Pratap Seth, who was a radical non-dualist. He was a businessman, an industrialist, but a great philanthropist. He was convinced only Brahman is real. Everything else, he was committed either drishti srishti vadin or an ajatavad, one of those. And yet an industrialist. He ran a full industrial empire, but he did a lot of good work. A commentator said that generally we think charitable work, philanthropy does not go with non-dualism, which regards the world as a dream. Here was a man who regarded the world as a dream and gave away everything to help other people, including this Institute of Philosophy, which he set it up. And he inspired this professor, Malkani. Now, there was an American professor, George Burke, who went to India in 1950s to meet, as he put it, contemporary Vedantists, academicians, philosophers. So he went around India. He met a number of leading philosophers at that time who believed in Vedanta, taught Vedanta, Advaita Vedanta. And at least some of them were practitioners in their own right. So the section in which he describes Malkani is very interesting. He says, this little institute of dedicated to philosophy is dominated by the personality of its president, which is this G.R. Malkani. He is forthright in his, erect and forthright in his bearing, which displays his inner, integrity of character and his discipline, and a little brusque and rough in his exterior, which hides the inner warmth of devotion. Very nicely written. He is interested, and he has Kantian in his habits. That means Immanuel Kant was famously very rigid in his routine. The people of that town, I think, where did he live? Königsberg? It says that they could set their watches by his walk, evening walk. They would correct their watch. In those days, it was a big thing. Nowadays, you're staring at me. Why would anybody want to do that? Yeah, nowadays, the internet does it for you, your phones. But in those days, he would have to check and correct. And every day, it was a thing of adjusting the watch. So they would look at his walk. It's 3 p.m., definitely. He has come for a walk, means it must be 3 p.m. He would walk up to the village square, up to the church steeple, and then he would walk back. Once the priest asked, the father asked the Professor Kant, that what do you do? You come up to the church and go back. What do you do there? You stop for a while. He said, I look at the clock in the tower and I adjust my watch. And the father was aghast. He said, but we adjust our watch looking at you. Anyway, so this Professor Malkani was, George Burke says, Malkani was Kantian in his habits. No doubt the good folk of Amalner adjusted their watches by his evening walks. And the very interesting statement, he says, he does not leave Amalner except to attend the annual conference of the Philosophers' Conference. He is not interested in anything except philosophy, and in no philosophy except Vedanta, and in no Vedanta except his own. In no Vedantic theories except his own. His approach is very interesting. He would read Vedanta, and then he would put it aside. He said he actually forgot it. He tried to forget it, and then think through the same problems himself, come to an understanding using our modern understanding of reason, logical approach. You think it out, reason it out, and come to. So if you read his writings, I came across this book, Swami Tathagatanji's collection, The Metaphysics of Advaita Vedanta, published in 1961, where all that we teach, he presents it with kind of very austere, very minimalistic logic, without referring back to Upanishads and they said this or that person said this, just clearly thinking it through. So there's a chapter on Drishti Srishti Vada there, and what I'm going to do in the remaining time is this. He takes up possible objections against it. Against what? Treating our waking as a dream. We don't. Thank God we don't. But Drishti Srishti Vada urges us to take this waking as a dream. And in fact, here Vasishtha is telling Rama that this is like a dream. So, what are the objections? And then he gives the answers. I'll share with you the traditional answers given by Gaudapada, for example. So Gaudapada, in the Mandukya, Upanishad and Karika, three states, we talk about waking, dreaming, deep sleep. Gaudapada reduces it to two states, sleeping and dreaming. Waking is a kind of dreaming, dreaming is a kind of dreaming, both are kinds of dreaming, and sleeping is sleeping. The reality is Brahman. So what are Gaudapada's answers, the traditional Advaitic answers to these objections to Drishti Srishti? And also the independent logical analysis given by Malkani. A little subtle but powerful sort of reasoned on first principles. I'm going to share this with you. First objection. Objection to what? This world is not a dream. Why not? Well, first, we share a common world. See, in your dream, you dreamt of something, I dreamt of something. You did not see what I saw. I don't agree with what you saw. My experience does not agree with your dream. But this one, we are all agreeing. We all agree. If you are asked, we'll say, yes, we are in the Vedanta Society of New York. We are listening to this rather mystifying talk. So we'll all agree on this. We have a common world which we share. How can this, and this common world which we share means that it must be exterior to us. It's not internal to our imagination. How would you explain this if it's a dream? How are we all dreaming the same thing? It's possible in virtual reality. We can create a virtual reality environment and we can all enter that and it's virtual and yet we agree we are in the same reality. But in a dream, it's private. So the traditional answer would be, but that's common world shared is also there in dreams. Think about it. You're comparing a dream with your waking and then finding that the dream is not shared. But in your dream, when you had forgotten that it was a dream, you were lying down and sleeping, and in the dream, you were meeting with people. And you were talking with people, maybe quarreling with people, maybe having fun. Did people there say, I'm sorry, I don't see you. You are there in your dream. I'm not there in your dream. Nobody says that. When you have sharing a cup of coffee with your cup of tea with your friends, does your friend say that, I can't see the cup, you are not dreaming hard enough, it's in your mind, it's not in my mind. No, everybody agrees in the dream that it's just like a waking dream, a waking experience. So you can't say that sharing a common reality is a sign of waking, is something other than a dream. In a dream also, exactly the same thing happens. This is the traditional answer. What Malkani does is, he says, I'll just give you his way of thinking. He says, forget the dream. Come to this waking world. Do we really share a common reality? If you actually carefully inquire, each of us is looking at this from a different angle, thinking about it differently. That's why we don't get along so well together, because we have different perceptions of reality. Especially in human relationships, we have different takes on what's happening here. So he says, it's not precisely true that we share the same reality. We have only our subjective view of reality. And then he puts it very powerfully. He says, this world, so-called common shared world, and the people in it, and our common agreed upon, this agreement which we have, it's only in your subjective experience. There's no way of independently verifying it from a God's eye point of view. There really are these people and there is really a reality and they're agreeing upon it. No, that also is in your appearance, in your experience, just as it is in your dream, in this waking world also. Then the next objection comes, is that, see, this cannot be a dream. We can't take it as a dream. Dreams come and go. Every day there are different dreams and the objects in the dreams are unstable. Every day, as I said, the pizza, it's not there. Next dream, it's not there. The people, the objects, the events, they are disconnected. They come and the dreams disappear every day when you wake up. But the waking is persistent. The same people are there, the same objects are there, the same body is there. So how can you say things persist and therefore they must be real? The argument, precise argument is this. If I recognize the same object across time, I say that this is the same lectern, the same podium from which I lectured last Sunday. And this is this Sunday. Across different points of time, it can't be in my mind. There must be an external object to which I'm referring. Just like that, there must be an external world to which we are referring. You see the argument? And the argument, again, traditional answer for this argument from Drishti-Srishti-Vada is the same thing is true in a dream. In the dream, we don't see things popping in and out of existence. You take up a cup of tea to drink and by the time you bring it to your lips, the cup has disappeared or the tea has disappeared. And do you say that, oh, it's a dream, it happens. No, we feel things persist. We recognize people in dreams. We interact with people, we have memories. So our dreams also have a consistency within the dream. Things don't just come and go and shock us by that, why are things behaving so strangely? But no. Things persist, things are recognized, people are recognized. It's almost like a copy of waking life. So that's the argument. Just because things seem to persist in your experience does not mean that it's a external reality. Malkani here gives his arguments. He says, actually we don't recognize things as the same. When we do recognize things as the same, they really are not. Science has shown us things are continuously changing. We don't recognize or see the change. And we internally make a judgment, this is the same as that. But science will tell you it is not. It has changed. So, then he makes a very subtle point, which is applicable to Advaita. This is the beauty of Malkani. He says, about the continuity of external objects, we have to take a subjective judgment of it. Yes. Based on my understanding, this was the same person whom I saw yesterday. This is the same place which I saw 10 years back. That's my subjective judgment. And science also shows that it's not true really. It is entirely subjective. However, he says, as far as our self goes, consciousness goes, awareness goes, we have an internal mandate, an internal proof that we are the same. It's a very subtle point. It's not depending on memories to say, I have memories of my past and so therefore I am that person now. No. Just the sense of, just look at the awareness itself. Apart from anything else, the awareness itself is always the same and it is self-proved. You never doubt it. That another awareness has come. What would it even mean? One awareness has gone, another awareness has come. One object has gone, another object has come. Awareness is always the same. I don't know how many appreciate it. It's a very subtle argument. Internally, there is a kind of irrefutable proof of our continuity. External objects continue. This is our judgment. It depends on a kind of subjective judgment about the world. Here we'll bring in Ma Sharada. Once, she was having this discussion with one of her monastic disciples, Swami Arupananda. So this is in their discussions and in his reminiscences. She says to him, a common saying in Bengali, Sri Ramakrishna often said it, Jamon bhav tamon lab. As your spiritual attitude is, that in that way you will realize God. So you worship God as Krishna, you will realize God as Krishna and so on. And this Swami Arupananda, he was quite argumentative, luckily for us, because he would ask all these questions. He said, but then that's like a dream. You dream a lot, you think a lot about something, it'll come in your dreams. So this so-called attitude, I worship God as Krishna or Kali, I visualize God in this way, and one day I will realize God in that way. Well, that's like a dream. It's subjective. You have filled your mind with those thoughts and emotions and it generates that. That was his question. It's like a dream. And then she says, yes, a dream. If not a dream, then what else? Shapno boi arki. And then he says, ei jagottao to shapno. This world, which you are, this world, She says, this is a dream. Not like a dream, this is a dream. And then she sweeps her arm around and she says, Eshab, Eshab, Shapno. And within brackets, the Swami writes, Jagrat. All of this is a dream. The Swami writes within brackets, our waking state. So literally a statement of Drishti Srishtivada. This is a dream. And then the Swami gives this particular argument. The Swami says, no, mother, this is not a dream. Dreams disappear and objects in dreams, this is literally his argument, the same one which Malkani faces. But the world of waking persists. And then he says, it has persisted for lifetimes. It's been this world and I am this person going through this life and many lifetimes probably. So it's persisted. And the mother's answer was not an argument. She said, Tahuleiba, she says, Shapno Vaito Noi. Let that be so. It's nothing other than a dream. Let that, even if it persists, it's nothing other than a dream. And then she gives that anecdote of which Sri Ramakrishna was fond of. The farmer who had one son, he went to sleep and he dreamt that he was a king with 8 princes. And in the dream, something terrible happened and all the princes died. And he woke up to hear the terrible news that his son, that one son in the waking state, has passed away due to some calamity. And his wife was saying, how hard-hearted you are. You're not weeping for our son. He's saying, it's not that. I'm thinking whether I should weep for those 8 I lost there or the son, one son I lost here. And that's the kind of brutal story. But the point being made is, he's equating the dream with the waking. That was also an appearance. This is also an appearance. Then there is another objection which comes up is law. I'll quickly run through it. This is an objection which Bill Conrad often threw at me. So he says that, look, the external world is real because there is regularity there. There is law there. Dreams are random, erratic. You know the traditional answer. The dream itself, in the dream itself, doesn't seem to be erratic. And only when we wake up and we think it's weird. But in the dream, it seemed pretty regular. And Malkani gives a more deeper answer to this, a more theoretical, principled answer to this. He says, look, whether you say in this world, whether you say is law because God made it so, or the Big Bang made it so, nature made it so. But then I can always say in the dream, those things happened because our desires, our unconscious made it so. I can always say that this universe is such because Maya made it so. In principle, there is no difference between, attributing law to one thing rather than the other. Dream is in a particular way. It has its own patterns because of our desires, our unconscious. This has these patterns. You are saying it's because of science, because of the Big Bang. So the theist can say that God has given those patterns. We are saying because of Brahman, these patterns are appearing. So this is one answer. Another objection. We are running out of time, but we have got endless objections to the dream. One little information I'll give you is that Swami Nikhilanandaji, in his book on the Mandukya Upanishads and Mandukya Karika, he has added an appendix because that book equates dream with waking and we have many objections to such a view. He takes up 10 possible objections and he gives answers to all those objections. At the end of it, you feel rather creepy because you begin to think this must be a dream then. Okay, a couple of more objections and then we'll stop. Objections and answers. A powerful objection is this. Look, if you equate dream and waking, you're erasing the difference between truth and falsehood. Why? I'm very aware of the clock. Now, if I show you this clock, you'll say it's a real clock. Right. Now, if I imagine the clock in my mind, now, do I have 2 clocks? No. There is one real clock and one you are imagining. The one you are imagining is not real. The one which is external, that is real. Now, if you say the external is a dream, internal is also a dream, there is really then no difference. Then, in that case, you are erasing the difference between truth and falsity. Then how will you judge what is true and what is false? Your so-called Brahman, how do you know that's true also? So that's a subtle but important. This is an epistemological doubt. Now, Gaudapada answers, and Malkani here agrees with Gaudapada's answer, would be this, that it is possible to have cancellations based on truth in dream also. What it means is, in the dream, we can see a clock, and we can imagine a clock, and we can say that that's an imaginary clock, this is a real clock. And then we wake up, we realize both were imaginary. It's possible. You can see a snake in a dream and say, oh, let me look, is it that Vedantic, famous Vedantic snake, and is it really a rope? And we see, oh, it's a rope. So the snake was false, the rope is real. But when you wake up, neither there's a snake, nor it's just you read too many Vedanta books. That's what was coming up. So the answer is, truth and falsity are also possible in the dream. Even in this way, we can make a distinction. It can be that it doesn't mean that there is really an external world in order to maintain truth and falsity. You can have truth and falsity, and the whole thing can also be part of an appearance. Then an associated question would be, how do you know that Brahman itself is not a part of an appearance? If you're saying this is a dream, and in a dream also you can wake up from a dream. From a dream I woke up into this waking world. Then from the waking world you're saying I wake up into enlightenment and Brahman. How do I not know there are further and further higher levels of reality? You can wake up into something higher than that. Who knows? He says, no, you cannot. Because of the very nature of Brahman, the ultimate reality, Brahman, is consciousness. It is existence. If you wake up from existence into something different, what's different from existence? Non-existence. So it doesn't exist. Anything is different from Brahman. If you wake up from consciousness, what will you experience? Nothing. You will not experience at all. Because consciousness is necessary for all experience. Whatever you wake up from and you say that was false and this is true, it requires consciousness. You can't come into an experience and say, consciousness is false, I realize it now. But that requires consciousness. So you cannot wake up from Brahman. You can wake up into Brahman if you see that argument. That's a very interesting, neat argument there. And just for the sake of completion, a couple of other objections and arguments, I'll just mention it. I will not explain, there's no time. One objection is the one about solipsism. Solipsism means, so notice where this is going. In the dream, in the waking, how many of us are here? Maybe 50, 70, 80 people right now. And how many are there online? Maybe 1,400 people watching online live now. That's amazing. So we have nearly 1,500 people. And we admit they're all different. But in our dream, suppose this was a dream, and you were dreaming all this, really how many would be there in the dream? One only, the dreamer, appearing as 1,400 people. So only oneself. Are you saying, do you have the chutzpah to say, right now only you exist and the rest of us are all in your dream? There's only one person. Not only one Brahman, but only one person. This is called solipsism. Solipsism means only one knower. So it's regarded as a fallacy, as a problem in philosophy. And Vedanta has a very good answer for it. There's one school of Vedanta which bites the bullet and says, yes, there is only one knower. There's only one person. Who's that? It's you. The rest of us are all in your dream. Your guru is in your dream. Your God is in your dream. Your world is in your dream. The only one who really exists is you. And you lend existence to the rest of us. When you stop dreaming, we'll all disappear. Don't stop right now because I have to finish the lecture. That is called Eka Jivavada, the doctrine that there is only one sentient being. Who is that? That's you. A pretty lonely you in that case. I read a science fiction story in which people suddenly realize they are all part of the dream of one person in the story. And it's very touching that the character is asking that person who is dreaming all this, is asking, we don't really exist, do we? We are parts of your dream. Actually, it was a lady who had lost all her, like her husband, her children. So she's dreaming, and her dream is so powerful, she actually creates this. I mean, there's a town and a husband and children and everybody's there. And so they suddenly, the other characters realize that they are being dreamt. So suddenly one of them asks that lady, I think her son, a little boy, asks, "We don't really exist, do we, mother?" And she says, "No. I made you out of my sadness and my tears." So touching that the projection, one sentient being creates the entire universe, and then suddenly realizes, I am limitless existence, consciousness. And the whole thing disappears back into infinity. So that is the solipsism example, the objection. And then there is one final objection, which is called Agyata Satta. We are seeing this, and you are saying whatever we see, it exists. But whatever we do not see, those things don't exist. But that's crazy. There's a whole world out there which we are not seeing. And there are stars and planets on which things are happening or nothing is happening, and we don't see them. You say they don't exist, and they pop into existence when we are seeing them. And so the answer to this, I've given this answer a number of times. Bill Conrad's question about, does the room not exist when we are not in it, Swami, and let's take a picture of it, we put a camera, we leave the room, and we see the pictures in the camera, and we will see the room exists without us, without any conscious being. The room exists, the world exists. Srishti Drishti Vada. That's most common sense. If you remember my answer to Bill, it was that, Bill, in your consciousness, you set up this experiment, put a camera, and you invited me to leave the room. In your consciousness, we all left the room. In your consciousness, we came back into the room. In your consciousness, we took a look at the pictures showing an empty room. At which point have we left your consciousness? Vedanta says, as known and as unknown, the universe exists in consciousness. We are mixing up knowledge with existence. We know this much, but also we also know that there is an unknown universe out there. But that unknown thing also, that there is something unknown, that's also in your awareness. There's nothing really outside this global awareness we are talking about. Awareness does not just mean attention or what we are thinking about right now. Our entire worldview, this entire understanding of the universe, our non-understanding of the universe, our memory, our forgetting, our vision, our perception, non-perception, all of it is appearing and disappearing in awareness. That awareness you are. It's a dream, as the mother said. That may be so, my son, but it's nothing but a dream, nothing more than a dream, this appearance we have. So that is Drishti Srishti Vada, the other amazing philosophy, it's actually a pedagogy. It's not a philosophy in itself. It's a methodology of pointing us towards the non-dual truth. One word about how you can use it in our spiritual inquiry, in our Vedantic inquiry. More detailed explanation, if you want, we have to wait for Greg Good. He's a master of this approach. He's going to come and guide us towards enlightenment next month. So keep the date open. I think it's in April. In April, one month after that, in April, Greg Good is a teacher of the direct path. He teaches a system which is distilled from Advaita Vedanta based on this Drishti Srishti Vada from a master called Atmananda, Krishna Menon, who was in the south of India in Kerala in the 1950s and 60s. Joseph Campbell, who was here in the East Side Center, disciple of Swami Nikhilananda Ji. So he writes in this book, Bakshish and Brahman. He went on a trip to India with Swami Nikhilananda in 1950s, early 50s. He met Pandit Nehru, met many of the leading people at that time. He says, really the spiritual teacher I wanted to meet, and he was doing this with traveling with the Swami, the person I really wanted to meet was this Atmananda Krishna Menon, because I find his teachings on non-duality are the most direct. Well, Atmananda Krishna Menon is gone, but his teaching lineage continues. So Greg Good is one of them. He is going to come and talk about it. It goes something like this. Can I take 2 minutes more and then we'll wrap up? Yeah, we have gone more than 1 hour, as usual. It's this. When you see this lectern, this podium, don't think that I'm seeing a podium. Just stick closely to your experience. Yeah, keep your eyes open. See your experience. What is your experience? Don't say it's a podium. Say, I see brown. I see brown. I see a shape. That much you can say. Don't immediately attribute it to, you don't see a podium. You see the brown, you see the shape. I'm not really touching a podium. I'm feeling some pressure, some temperature and pressure. This idea of a podium is built up in the mind through sense inputs. Now this brown, if you see, think about it. What did you see? It was a color, a patch of color floating in my awareness. There is no evidence in my experience of something external to awareness which my awareness has gone forth like a beam of life and touched this and then revealed it to me. That's normally what we think. When you see a podium in a dream, what happens? Is there actually a podium and then you opened your eyes and saw it? No, just because you saw it, it appeared in your seeing. It is saying, how is this different now? What you see and hear and smell and taste and touch are part of that seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. They're not external to it. And whatever we are seeing is, if you see, right now, I'm seeing all these shapes and colors. This seeing is nothing other than consciousness or awareness. It's like a layer on awareness or like a wave in an ocean of awareness. This different kinds of aware experiences. This is what the philosopher Timmal Sinha, he calls it non-dual seeing. Non-dual seeing means I, the awareness, experience myself in these forms as this sense, bundle of sensations which I call a body, as this other bundle of sensations which I call objects being experienced. This is non-dual. Non-dual because there's only one here, consciousness. This non-dual seeing is happening. That's the universe, that's the person, that's Brahman. And that's entirely problem-free. There's nobody, nothing outside it. Whatever we experience, ever have experienced, ever can experience. If you experience God, it must be in this non-dual consciousness. Where else will you experience God? If you experience the world, it must be in this non-dual consciousness. The process is this. Start with your experience. Don't start with an object outside. That's why it's drishti srishti vada. Start with the experience. Then notice the experience is nothing other than the experiencing. The objects in the experience are nothing other than the experience. This is nothing other than seeing. This is nothing other than touching going on here. Smell, taste. But the smell, taste, seeing, hearing are nothing other than awareness itself. Magically, due to awareness, it's amazing. Like colors appearing in the dream. There is no light there, but how can colors appear? But it appears. The mind projects its own colors. Consciousness projects its own sensations, thoughts. As outside, so-called inside. This outside inside also is appearing in consciousness. That one non-dual seeing, you are. After all, who else is there? The personality also appears in that non-dual seeing. Other persons, so-called, appear in that non-dual seeing. This non-dual seeing is what always was, is and will be. Even time is a part of this non-dual seeing. Space is a part of this non-dual seeing. So-called causality is also an appearance in this non-dual seeing. One way of looking at this is, this non-dual seeing itself, when you look at it as from the perspective of existence, reality, it appears as causality in this world. Things, causes and effects. When you look at this non-dual seeing from the perspective of knowledge, this non-dual seeing itself appears as the knower, as the object of knowledge, and the method of knowledge. Knowledge itself. When this non-dual seeing, you look at it from the perspective of joy, purpose, meaning, bliss, this non-dual seeing itself appears as what is called bhokta and bhogya, consumer and consumed, enjoyer and enjoyed, sufferer and the suffered. The same non-dual seeing. But at all times, this non-dual seeing is ever free of cause and effect, is ever free of the difference between knower and known, the difference between enjoyer and enjoyed. Where cause and effect are one, where knower and known are one, where enjoyer and enjoyed are one, where? In that non-dual seeing. That is Brahman. That is you, Tattvamasi. I pray to Sri Ramakrishna, Ma Sharada, Swami Vivekananda, and the Master Vashishta thousands of years ago. May this knowledge flash in our lives, and may our lives be blessed, and may we become a blessing to others also. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Shri Ramakrishna Rupanamastu. Yes, there are two questions. I'll take the young man's question first and we'll come to you. Yeah, just ask. And don't worry about the microphone, I'll repeat the question. Yeah, the objections.
They never really gave a answer.
Which one? Object to what?
To song.
Repeat the... which objection are we talking about here?
This
is solipsism?
Yeah.
Okay. That I didn't have time, but... I'll give you two or three observations there. One is, actually, solipsism means I am the only reality and you are all part of my experienced world, you are not real. That is solipsism. The one subject is real and all the others are appearances in that subject's experience. But Advaita Vedanta is not saying that. It deconstructs that one subject also. Advaita Vedanta starts with yourself and says, I'm not the body, not the mind. So you've already pushed aside the so-called subject. Then you come to an impersonal consciousness, which is common to all subjects. And you say, that is the only reality ultimately. That is the only knowing subject ultimately. The capital S, the only self. So it's technically not what is known as solipsism, criticized as solipsism in philosophy. So it's not that particular fault. But still you would say, ultimately, it boils down to the same thing. It sounds suspiciously like solipsism. And then Advaita Vedanta would say, yes, there is. You can do that also. That's ekajivavada. That comes as a consequence of this drishti-srishti-vada. Ekajivavada means one sentient being only, which is very much like solipsism. But even there, notice it's a teaching methodology. Because ultimately you are supposed to realize that you are one Brahman, not one being. The ultimate, you are not the ultimate being. So perish that thought. So solipsism is not the final teaching. Solipsism can be a teaching methodology. This particular Vedantic kind of solipsism. Okay, one more subtle point. Since you have asked, I couldn't say this, but I've got this opportunity now. Malkani again. Such subtle observations. Notice this. He says, you're saying that solipsism is a fault because there's only one self, but there are so many selves. It's very demeaning to dismiss all of us as your dream, you know. We are all real. And we are all separate selves. And we are interacting with each other. The inter-self communication is going on. This is what the world is. How can you dismiss all the other selves? Malkani says, if you talk about a self, what is the self? In our experience, there is only one experience of the self, which is the I. Even you is only secondarily a self to me, because I impute upon you that they are like me, they behave like me, they look like me, they talk like me. So internally, I have the sense of self. They also must have a sense of self internally. But primarily for us, in our experience, the self is found only in the I. Now he goes further. Even the I, he calls it the I form, ahankara, that also is an object in our experience. Just as I'm aware of this, I'm also aware of this. I'm aware of the breath as this breath. Then go more subtle. I'm aware of thoughts, memories, emotions, perceptions, subtle. They are also objects. And among them, I'm aware of the sense of I. All of us, the ego, the I. If you're aware of the sense of the I, Malkani here makes a subtle distinction between I, the pure I, the capital I, and the I form, ahankara. The ahankara is also part of the world. But the real I is the witness of the ahankara. And then he says, this, the real I, the witness consciousness, has this peculiar relationship with the ahankara, because that's the only way you will find the witness consciousness. You will not find it here, you will not find it here, you will not find it in the breath, you will not even find it in emotions, thoughts, you will find it in that, you know, what Sri Ramakrishna used to call the rascal ego. But behind the rascal ego is the God eye, the witness of that little eye, the witness of the eye form. So this is in Upanishad, Mandukya Upanishad, Ekatma Pratyaya Saram, that Atma Pratyaya, this sense of I, one's own existence. If you, Shankaracharya says, if you investigate that, you will come to the real self. So that's the meaning of the one self, not what is normally dismissed as solipsism. And all of this, of course, I'm borrowing in toto from Malkani. See, forgotten man. Very interesting. Oh, there's another anecdote. Swami Pitambaranji told us about this anecdote. In Nagpur, many years ago, 1950s, so the Swami there, Bhaskarishwaranja, great, he was an enlightened being in his own lifetime, disciple of Swami Shivananda and all. He in a program, invited this Malkani for a talk, who is a professor, well-known professor of Advaita. Among the speakers was this Malkani, in a public gathering. Now, they were not trained philosophers. So Malkani started off by denying the existence of God, and which led to everybody getting upset. Already some people are looking upset. People got furious with him, and the Swami had to play the peacemaker. He had to stand up and explain what Malkani really meant, that he is talking about the real nature of God, not the way we understand God and so on. So the Swami Pitambaranji told me this anecdote. I mean, he mentioned this anecdote in one of his talks. Last question. Okay, we have run out of time. You can ask me later. Yes.
One question. Swami.
Yes.
The four paths of yoga that Swami Vivekananda talks about, can you overlay that on the three paradigms that you discussed today?
Today, all of which we did is Jnana Yoga. Mm-hmm. It's a path of inquiry. All of it. The Bhakti Yoga, the Jnana Yoga, the Karma Yoga, they all take the Srishti Drishti approach. That the world is there and you engage with the world as it appears to you. The body is there, the mind is there, other people are there, problems are there. Now, how do you engage with the world? Through devotion, through selfless service, and through control of the mind. Karma Yoga, Bhakti Yoga, Raja Yoga. It takes it as very much a real world, traditionally. And Advaita also takes it as a real world in Srishti Drishti. But things get a little weird when you come to Drishti Srishti, and totally weird when you come to Ajatavada. Thank you so much.
Thank you.